Welcome to Life, Lessons, and Laughter with your host, Glenn Ambrose.
And we're back.
Hi, Aubrey.
Hi.
And we're back. Do you like my entrance?
I did. I loved it. It was a great entrance. You can tell it's the second podcast of the night.
This is it. Second podcast. Uh-huh. We're all goofed out. Yep. And for those of you who care, there's 164 pages in the front of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had to check. So this is my big book. I had to put a cover on it because it's falling apart so bad. This is all like falling apart. So this was used hardcore, man. Like I open it up and just chunks are falling out.
Amazing. That's how it should look.
Amazing. This is it. It's been, you know, it's used. It's supposed to be used just like your good china. So if you have your good china in a case somewhere, use it
right
tomorrow.
Right.
Yeah.
Agreed.
So before I forget, I was going to start with the disease mentality. So this is the way that I learned the disease. And I believe I learned it from Joe and Charlie. If anybody is interested in recovery, man, there's these guys, Joe and Charlie. And I heard about them, or I think I just heard about them. So like I asked, when my birthday came around, it was like I got sober August 1st. My birthday is August 7th. So I was like, I must have really wanted to get sober because I didn't even drink on my birthday. And I only had 6 days sobriety.
Yeah.
It was around August 1st, I guessed. I'm not exactly sure what day, but my year anniversary, I'm like, get me Joe and Charlie CDs. So I got this set of CDs with Joe and Charlie used to travel around the country, maybe around the world, and do big book studies. And they go through and stuff, and they're pretty entertaining in it. And it was really cool. So I believe it was there that I learned this mentality about it. But the way that it's explained, because it was determined that alcoholism was a disease. So what they said was that basically the body breaks down alcohol into acetone, which is fingernail polish remover, and everything else. And your body expels everything else. Then it takes the acetone and it breaks the acetone down at the rate of about an ounce an hour. This is where they got the an ounce an hour rule. So basically, if you're a non-alcoholic and your body is breaking down acetone at the rate of an ounce an hour, if you drink more than that, your body starts going, hey, wait a minute, acetone is poison. You have poison in your body. Like it's not good to have more poison in your body faster than I can break it down. So maybe you should slow down. And it starts giving people like sometimes they feel a little nauseous. They feel a little woozy and they're like, whoa, their body is sending signals that maybe you should slow down here, you know? And if you're a non-alcoholic, and now don't get me wrong, you know, like I grew up in a town filled with heavy drinkers. So like there are many non-alcoholics that don't just stop there. You know, there's many people going out and getting tore up on a regular basis. And it doesn't mean that they're an alcoholic. But that is, you know, so this is a basic overview. So it's like, but people who really don't like never really go out and get drunk, that's how they feel. You know, like my mom's like that. She's like, she'll have a drink, you know, and she'll be like, oh, I'm starting to feel it. I better stop. And I'm like, to me, I'm like, that's when I get going. You know, that's my leaping off point. Like when I, yeah, it's like when I start feeling it, I'm like, oh, thank God I'm starting to feel it. Okay. It's go time. Let's go. You know, like, but non-alcoholics like, oh, I'm starting to feel it. Maybe I should slow down. So like, you know, so that's a non-alcoholic. What happens with an alcoholic is they don't have the enzymes of sufficient quantity or quality to break down the acetone at the rate of an ounce an hour. So what happens is they found that if your body is not breaking down the acetone properly and it just sits in your body, it actually kind of does a flip-flop. So instead of telling you, hey, wait a minute, you know, you got poison, slow down, it does the opposite and starts creating a physical craving for more acetone. So this is why, like, people, you know, you, if you're an alcoholic, you have a mind obsession about drinking, you know, like if I wasn't, especially if it, if it gets worse and worse, if I wasn't drinking, I was thinking about drinking, you know, it's, you know, if I was at work and I wasn't drinking, it was like, oh, I can't wait till I get out of work so I can go whack down a few beers, you know? So I had the mind obsession, but there's also a physical craving that your body literally craves it.
Yeah.
So, which increases the more alcohol you have in your system. So like when I thought back, when I learned this, I thought back and I was like, you know what? If like I said, I didn't make a lot of excuses for my drinking. In fact, somebody didn't like the fact that I drank, you may go. So that's just how I was, you know? So, but every once in a while, you know, I had a girlfriend that I really loved when I was young and stuff. And it was like, every once in a while, I'd be in a situation where I'm like, I'm going to prove that, you know, like I don't have to drink or that I have a drinking problem or something. So I would have like one or two beers. And if I had a really, really good reason and I was really focused and committed to that reason, I could stop drinking.
Yeah.
Now, I was probably a miserable SOB for the rest of the night, but I could do it. Now, if I had six or eight beers in me, which that was just my beginning, you know, some people drink that like all night. That was my warm up. So if I had six or eight beers in me and like I didn't care what needed to be done or how committed I was to not staying out with my friends when I was supposed to meet my girlfriend, I was going to continue drinking.
Yeah. Once
I had six or eight in me, like nobody was going to stop me.
Yeah.
They have to be really big and carry a really big stick. And get me unconscious. Because that was the only way I was stopping.
You're not taking this away from me.
No, it just wasn't. It just wasn't on the table. It's for people who aren't an addict, you know, it's kind of hard to comprehend, but I just wasn't stopping. It was all I wanted to do and I was happy doing it. So
yeah.
Good. Thank you. Yeah. You know, and whatever consequence I have to pay, I'll work through that tomorrow, you know. So my girlfriend came and found me at bars a couple times.
Yeah.
Fairly upset.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But so this is how the disease works. So it's like, so you have a mind obsession as well as a physical craving, and that physical craving will last as long as alcohol is in your system, which can be 3 days, basically.
Yeah.
That's why all the detox spin dries are like 3 days, you know, yeah. Because you get the alcohol out of your system.
Yeah.
So then you no longer have the physical craving. You still have the mental obsession, but you don't have the physical craving. So it's like, you know, so what happens is you drink and then all of a sudden it triggers that physical craving and you drink more. And then you end up in a drinking spree all night or whatever. Then you feel bad, which makes you want to drink again. So you start over. And that, you know, like we talked about last time, that's a cycle.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's the disease mentality of it. It's like, you know, the way that they explained it was like, you know, it's an allergic reaction, basically.
I was going to say, yeah, that's how I was always, that's how it was relayed to me, like an allergy.
Yeah, it's an allergy. So like if you're allergic to strawberries and you eat strawberries, like your skin can break out and, mm-hmm. you know, your eyes can puff up. If you're allergic to something else that, you know, that it can upset your stomach, you can have diarrhea. Like, you know, there's physical symptoms from allergies. And this is so hard because, and I think, you know, what they said was, this is why it took so long to figure out alcoholics, because you had a non-alcoholic whose body didn't work that way, trying to figure out why an alcoholic was doing what they were doing. And they just can't, because they don't function that way.
Right.
You know, so how are you supposed to understand somebody's body and figure it out? How can you figure out somebody's body is doing something that yours doesn't do? Like, it's not even on the table.
It's in the blind spot, you know, of like, you don't know what you don't know.
And it's the opposite is true with an alcoholic. So an alcoholic is sitting there seeing, you know, I believe alcoholism is like 10% of the population. So they're seeing, you know, 90 out of 100 people drink without consequences, without being out of control of how they act or think. Yeah. So they're seeing other people drink casually with no problems. But the alcoholic can't climb into a non-alcoholic's body and go, oh, you guys don't feel this urge that I feel.
Right.
You know, he assumes everybody feels that urge because that's what his body is doing, you know? So this is why it was so hard to figure out and so hard for people to understand, is because the alcoholic can't understand what a non-alcoholic feels because they don't feel it. And a non-alcoholic can't understand what an alcoholic feels because they don't experience it.
Yep.
You know.
Yeah.
But it's powerful, man.
And that's what's so powerful about the program, you know, because you do have like a group of like-minded people that can be.
Yeah. And you start like I and a lot of other people I know got very excited when we found out we're alcoholics, because you think you're crazy.
Yeah.
You know, like you can't understand why your life is falling apart. You know, another way that I look at it is alcohol is not the problem. It's a solution.
Yep.
It's just a crappy solution. So it turns on you, you know, but it's a solution nonetheless, you know, because it's not the problem. The problem is we are maladjusted to life.
Yeah.
You know, the problem is we can't handle life the way it's happening. And there's all kinds of fear running around and, you know, and then all of a sudden we take a drink and we're like, oh my God, the fear, the uncomfortability is gone. You know, like, I mean, I was 15 years old. I could go talk to these, you know, so I was like a freshman. I could go to parties and talk to like senior girls, man, effortlessly. And I could be witty and fun. And I had liquid courage. If anybody gave me a hard time, I could stand up to them. You know, I was relaxed. I didn't have that nervousness, that fear of not fitting in, not being good enough. It was all gone, man. Yeah. That's why as soon as I drank the first time I drank a little too fast. And I was like, whoa, like ended up outside the party. I was like, whoa, like it was a little much. Right. But I knew that night, I was like, in the next morning, I woke up thinking about it. I was like, I think I'm onto something here. Like, I think I drank a little too fast and I didn't quite know how to handle it. But if I slow it down just a little bit, I think this might be magic.
Yeah.
And so I couldn't wait till the next weekend to try it again. And I did. I drank a little slower and I was like,
amazing.
I am on. I was everything I always wanted to be.
Yeah.
You know, or I thought I was.
Yeah.
You know, not everybody agreed with that. but yeah, it was, you know, so I was hooked. So what, you know, what I was doing is it was my solution to fear. It was my solution to inadequacy. It was my solution into not being good enough, not feeling good in my skin, you know, feeling awkward. It was my solution to all of that.
Yeah.
Getting picked on. I could stand up and fight everybody. It was like, you know, it helped me at that time. Mm-hmm. It served me for a while, you know?
Yeah.
And then the man takes the drink and the drink takes the man or the woman, yeah. You know? So.
Yeah. It's like anything else, you know, it works for you until it doesn't anymore.
Right. And then depending on what that is, sometimes it will cut you to shreds, you know? Yeah.
The consequences are very extreme. You know, it's life or death. I mean, really, it's life or death.
It is. Yeah. It is. And it's, you know, it's like the, you never know, you know, it's, yeah, I think I don't really ask myself this anymore. I don't think. But for years, you know, it would pop into my head once or twice a year. Like, why me? You know, why did I get it?
Yeah.
And I don't think I'll ever have an answer to that because so many of my friends are dead now. I mean, I can't even count. There's probably like over 100 people in my hometown alone that I know that are dead.
Crazy.
From this disease. Mm-hmm. And then plus, like all the people that I knew in Florida and like, I mean, and in halls in Rhode Island. And it's countless. It's how many lives, you know, this disease takes. And of course, when, you know, I talk about alcoholism because I was an alcoholic, but I'm talking about addiction across the board, you know, I'm kind of focused on the drugs, drugs and alcohol, you know, and that's not to minimize other addictions. I mean, I've kind of been involved with people with other addictions, mm-hmm. gambling, you know, helping them and working through stuff, gambling, eating addictions. Those are the real deal. You know, maybe they don't kill people as often or as fast or whatever. But because it's not such a physical thing, you know, mm-hmm. or, and the eating of course is, but like, you know, generally, a lot of people have eating disorders that don't end up 800 pounds and dead.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of the eating disorders, like even if it's just constantly gaining weight or constantly getting thin, a lot of times they'll, you know, it lasts longer. So it might not kill you as quickly as drugs and alcohol, but the mental and the physical aspects of it are just as dire, in my opinion. You know,
mentally and emotionally, it's very similar, if not the same. You know, it's just the variable is different, and certain variables are going to be more consequential than others. You know,
and sometimes
it's just a time frame.
You know, eating, like I said, like. You know, I mean, I think it probably kills less people. I'm going out on a limb on that one. But like there's an aspect of it that basically the cornerstone, the foundational piece of recovery up until this point has been abstinence.
Yeah.
You can't abstain from food.
Right.
You know, so that brings a different dynamic into it that makes it extremely difficult. You know, so it's, absolutely. And now I also have seen, you know, I'm just trying to make a point where it's the real deal and it should be taken seriously. And I understand that. And I hope other people do as well. You know, and even sex and relationships, those can tie you up, man. Wow.
Yep.
And, you know, and a lot of other things you know, we all have addiction problems. Every one of us has addiction problems in this day and age.
Absolutely.
You know, television, our phones, whatever, technology.
Absolutely.
We do stuff in a negative way and it's a problem. It's just some things will kill you quicker than others.
Right.
You know.
Yeah. Everything has a consequence. It's just a matter of time.
Right. And the mental and the emotional aspects of these addictions are all very similar, you know, and those vary too, but like, yeah, there's a lot of commonalities with them, but So yeah, I don't know what else.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's focusing on the solution and not the problem.
Yeah, and that's really that was something I learned, you know, early on. It was solution, not the problem. Solution, not the problem. And it's beautiful. This is why, like, you know, I take people through the big book, and it you know, it ended up taking me 6 months. It might even have taken me 8 months once to get through that first 164 pages, because, like, it's just this, the big book is spiritual text, man. It's it's as spiritual as the Bible. It's as spiritual as the Tao Te Ching or the Bhagavad Gita. It's like, it's amazing. And every time I would go through, of course, I was expanding my spirituality. So I'd be like, it's just chock full of gems in there. And I'm sitting there, you know, taking groups of people through, and I'm reading something out, because I had to read every word and tell them what to do. Underline, circle, this is what this means. And I'm sitting there reading something that wasn't underlined before, that is like a spiritual diamond. And I'm going like, all right, guys, so underline that in the margin, put this. This is what this means. So I kept adding to, because it's just too much. So yeah. Like, I'm going to, so the people that are watching the video, like, I'll show some of what I'm talking about. Like, it's just, I don't know how well you can see it, but it's just all underlined, circled, you know, and there's certain parts where you go, okay, underline this, and then in a margin put TFRD. I thought, felt, or drank like that. So if you thought like that, you put a T. If you drank like that, you put a D. If you felt like that, you put an F. A lot of times I was putting T, F, and D next to these things. But it's all, you know, all notes throughout this whole thing. All spiritual, just gold, you know, through the whole thing, everywhere. So I think, are you froze, Aubrey? Yeah, because your cat hasn't moved. I don't know if you can hear me. But I think I'm okay on my end, so I'm just going to keep going. We'll see. Oh, she popped off. Okay, maybe she'll come back in. So yeah, you know, my book is just chock full of stuff. And, you know, and I've taken a lot of people through, and I had friends start taking people through. And it was amazing to see all these people change. And, you know, what Aubrey just said, it was all about focusing on a solution. So, like, if you're in recovery or you're trying to, learn how to change your thinking, then it's, you know, focus on the solution. It's like, I used to go to meetings and sometimes they'd be, you know, people just be talking about their problems in life. And it's, I found this in the rooms of, you know, of AA, but I've also found it in life too. And this is unfortunately one of the things that happens in therapy a lot. So, oh, Aubrey's back.
Sorry, it kicked me off. It's something went wrong. I'm like, what? What do you mean?
Yeah, I was like, wait a minute. I was like, is Aubrey frozen?
I was like doing that thing where it was like this, and I thought it was you, but it was me. And I was like, hey, like, and I was making all, and everything was working fine with my camera, but it's okay. Here we are. I'm back.
Here we are.
Figured it out.
Yeah, I was just talking about what you said. You know, it's all about the solution.
Yeah.
And it's just, like, staying focused on the solution. And I go to meetings and you'd see the loop. Like, people would start talking about the problem. Oh, my life, this, oh, that, oh, and it turned into a group depression meeting, you know, like, so like, you know, I'd talk to my sponsor, and he's like, what did you, he's like, oh, you're complaining about a meeting. what did you do to change it? Oh, nothing. Yeah. So, you know, so, and my sponsor was like, he had about as much patience as I do. He probably had less patience than I do, because like, I have, I can't listen to people complain very long.
Yeah.
I just can't. It's just like, whatever. I understand you have a problem. Let's get to the solution. You know, but that's what happens in meetings, and it happens in life, and it happens in therapy a lot of times. What happens is people, whenever we do something good for ourselves, we feel our body gives us positive feedback. So when we purge how we're feeling and all this negativity out, that is technically healthy to get it off your chest, not to harbor it, not to stuff it down. So there is a positive aspect to that. So when people purge all their negativity, they feel relief. But what happens is they confuse that with actual change. And it's not change, because what they do is they just go back out in life. They get frustrated by the same type of thing. And then they go back to a meeting the next day, and then they throw up all over everybody. And then they feel a little bit better, and they go, oh, thank you for letting me share, everybody. I feel so much better. And then they go out and they create more crap, and then they go throw up at a meeting the next day. And they'll literally do that for years. And people will do that for years going talking to a therapist. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the same thing. It's like, what are you doing to change? So change how you interact with life so you don't continue having a problem at the end of the day. Right. You know, like
you ever want to get to the day where you don't have to dump all this out.
Yeah. Like it's not. Yeah. You want to create a way where you're interacting with life in a palatable way where you can actually enjoy most days, you know, and then, yeah. Okay. Every once in a while, something happens. You got to, you know, maybe talk to one of your friends or somebody about it to get it off your chest. Cool. You know, but like my clients, I do not sit there listening to my clients complain, because it's annoying. Like it zaps my energy. I don't want to sit there and listen. Like all I need to do, I'm listening underneath. I'm not paying attention to the details. And that's usually what people, that they get into telling their story and all the details in it. And they think that they're so important because their body is giving them positive feedback for purging. So they're like, oh no, this must be, yeah, I can tell it feels right inside. I'm getting relief. I'm getting release. I need to do. It's like, no. That's just a surfacey little release that you'll never get out of that loop ever. You know what we need? So like I've told clients sometimes, like if they really want to talk, I'm like, go get a therapist. They'll sit there and listen to you and take your money. Like I'm not doing that because I find it annoying. I just want to cut to the solution. So as soon as I hear enough, I interrupt my clients all the time, because as soon as I hear enough where I know what the problem is and we can get to the solution, I want to spend our time doing that, you know, because we only have an hour to sit down and talk. Yeah. So like, let's make the most of that hour. Let's get to the solution. Like you don't, it's funny when at first, if people aren't familiar with me and the way that I work, they're just like, well, I'm supposed to tell you my problems. Otherwise, how are you going to fix them? It's like, I already know what your problem is. You know, I knew about 30 seconds after you started talking what your problem was. So let's just get to the solution. Yeah. Instead of like, go call your friend or your mother and freaking talk to her if you want to purge shit. Like it's not worth paying me. I don't take insurance. Like you're paying good money to talk to me. It's not worth your money to sit here and, because that's your perspective.
Yeah.
Your perspective is the problem. Right. So let's hear my perspective.
Right.
You know, so you can get a different one.
Yeah. And the thing with purging I've noticed is when people purge like that, and they're in that loop, they'll kind of purge to whoever will listen. I mean, really, like I've seen
it. Oh, absolutely.
Like people, strangers, anyone, because it just is that, and it is that release. It's not because they mean to be annoying or anything. Like you said, it really is just, it feels good. And so they'll do it to whoever. And you're like, I know that
they'll
you're
do it to everyone.
Gas station about this. You'd really like talk. We're going to talk about solutions, you know?
Yeah.
Like
I'd be at work with a group of people and somebody would be purging. And I'd be like, I guess I feel like being social, kind of a part of the group today. So I would just stand there and I would be basically tuning out most of what they're saying because I wasn't interested.
Yeah.
And it would bring me down, you know, and it'd be like four of us in a circle or something. And then all of a sudden the fifth person would come over and they'd start the freaking conversation over. They'd be like, oh yeah, let me tell you what we're talking about, you know? And I'd be like, okay, I got to check out.
It's it's tough because I like to focus on facts versus stories. And when you hear the stories happening, you're just like, okay, like, but let's get to the baseline. This is all fluff and all these things. But like, what does it mean?
And they're so addicted to the purge that they like, if some people that aren't, you know, like I said, used to the way that I work, they'll be like, well, no, this is important, because they actually think it is.
Yeah.
And they have such a desire to speak it so they can get that relief. Like it's that, and they'll be like, no, like, so no, this is but this is important. I'd be like, okay, go ahead. They'd be like, all right. So we're at dinner, like I was saying, right? And so then the waitress comes over and he didn't know what he wanted to eat. And I did. So I went first. So I got the salmon. And I'm going, this is exactly what I'm talking about. I don't give a shit what you had for dinner. It's literally not important. No, but I'm getting to it. All right. And then he had the steak and I'm like, I can't do this. I can't. If you tell me one more fucking thing that was ordered, I'm hanging up the phone. If you tell me what your drink order is, I'm ending the call.
yeah
it's just but that's
like, I'll play for a minute, but once we get to drink orders, we're done with this conversation.
Wait, I can't if it has grenadine in it. I'm gonna choke somebody.
I know. People get really lost in the details.
I used to do it and I'm still a storyteller, so sometimes I still do it to some degree. And it's but see, the difference, the reason that I allow myself to do it to some degree, and I do try to hold it back when I'm in social situations more, out of respect for other people not listening to all the details, I do try to pull it back in those situations, but I allow myself to do it in other situations, like when I'm in my work situations, because my speech is my flow. That's how I ride the energy. And that's how things come out that I don't know that are going to come out. And that's how the solution comes out. So it's part of how I work. There's a purpose to it. And telling my stories, people can identify with my story and know it's not just them that's messed up, and know that I've been through it too, and see the solution in it also, you know. And I try to stay on topic to some degree, but again, it's, you know, there's a purpose to why I allow myself to do it. What they're doing is they're just talking about the problem, and I already know what the problem is. So there's literally no benefit to it. When I'm doing it, I'm bringing in the solution. So there is a reason, you know, there's a benefit to it. It has solution in it. It's, you know, it's a solution detail. It's not a, it's not a problem detail.
Right. It's coming from two different places, really.
Right.
Yeah. The intention. The intention is different, you know, and that's everything.
Different. And it's funny because most people don't, quite honestly, most people don't really listen when other people talk. You know, they're just waiting for them to shut up so they can say something. I actually listen intently. But I'm listening underneath. I don't, you know, people can be like talking for 5 minutes and it's like blah, 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 blah. And half the time, if they're really off on something, like my brain like kind of disconnects And I kind of hear like Charlie Brown's teacher stuff. I kind of hear like, wah, 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 wah. I almost don't even, sometimes I don't even hear the words that they're saying. And then all of a sudden they'll say something important and it like clarifies for me. And I'm just like, oh, right there. Yeah. That's the piece that I needed.
And that's then, all I heard. That's all I got. Yep.
Yeah. And if I'm feeling like, sometimes I feel that there's more. So I'll be like, okay, mental note. And then want, and then clarity. And then I'll be like, oh, okay, there's the other piece. All right. Those are the two that I needed. You know, and then I'll be like, okay, you know, I gotta interrupt you now. So, and then start going into the solution. Or sometimes it's just, if it's wah for like 3 minutes straight, I'm like, okay, this is just a waste of my time and it's a waste of your time.
Yeah.
But they're not used to that. And they're not used to people being able to listen underneath the words, because I'm constantly looking for that piece. Like, what needs to be adjusted?
Yeah.
Not what are they saying? What is it pointing to that needs to be adjusted? Oh, it's pointing to this. It's pointing to the fact that they don't feel good about themselves. Oh, so it's a self-esteem issue. Okay, good. Let's deal with the self-esteem issue. You know? And it's so then you start, then I start talking about the self-esteem issue. So it's like, yeah, but it, you know, it wasn't, but I could tell that because they wanted the salmon and they ordered the steak because he ordered the steak.
Right. Not about the details of the steak or the salmon. But
no, I'm sitting here going like.
Right. It's very clear too. And I think too, it's when your emotion isn't in it, you know, and you're hearing it from that outside, like when I have conversations like that, you know, I'm not invested emotionally in whatever they're dealing with. So it's like very clear to me. I can see like point A, point B, like it's just a straight line for me. And for them, there's so much emotion. You know, and you can't think with logic and emotion at the same time. If it's very traumatic and you go into fight or flight, you know, with emotion, I think it shuts off your frontal lobe, I believe. And you actually can't think. Like you can't physically, like you cannot separate the two because you're so overwhelmed with emotion. You cannot think logically. And I think that's a big thing too. You know, it's getting people down from that emotional level to understand logic. Otherwise I'll just live in that story, you know, and that's.
Yeah. And that's exactly it. And it's cool that science has proven this stuff at this point, you know, because it's like, we have scientific proof. It's like, you know, there's literally your blood and your nutrients start getting derailed away from your brain, pushing into your major muscle groups. So you can fight or flee. And it's like, so you literally are incapable of thinking properly.
It's not. It's
because they don't want you thinking.
Right. I've experienced that. And I had a therapist actually went over that with me because I couldn't understand, like when I would get into, I was in kind of like I was in a relationship and there was a lot of, you know, up and down fighting, that kind of stuff. But it was so intense that I there were times I just like couldn't think. I couldn't think. And I'm like, I don't understand why my brain just physically stops working. Like, it's just, you could ask me a date of something and I would just be like, what? Like I would have no ability to even think that. So that's, you know, and when she explained that to me, I'm like, oh, that makes so much sense. But it's helpful knowing that with other people. You just got to bring them down from that emotional level.
Yeah. Yeah. And it is, and it's important to know that we all are like that. You know, it's like when it's my stuff, you know, like I have to go talk with people sometimes still because it's my stuff. So I have emotion around it. So emotion clouds my vision, just like emotion clouds everybody else's vision. You know, right. I mean, I've learned tricks and ways to work through it and cut through it and stabilize myself and all this stuff. So maybe it happens to me a little less than some people, but it still does happen to me, you know? So it's we're all made like that. Emotions, you know, everything has a job, and emotions' job is not to think. It's not to figure stuff out. You know, that's not your logical brain.
Yeah. You know?
But what else we got to say about addiction? I mean, it's, yeah, I mean, it's all solution based.
I guess if there's anyone listening that's struggling with the with addiction, what would be your first, you know, like they're kind of in this hopeless state of mind, not really sure what direction to go. What would be your advice?
Yeah. And I always kind of get stuck on this one because, like, you know, I've said this about meditation. I don't believe that there is one way that works for everybody, mm-hmm. you know, and I just foundationally cannot believe that. But there are times when you have to play odds, you know, or think about variables. And it's like with meditation, okay, I can't see how you can have a peaceful life without learning to slow your mind down. So maybe it's just different types of meditation. With addiction, like, are there other ways to transcend addiction? Because I think that's, you know, like I was saying before, that's really the point. It's to transcend it, not to live with it. Yeah. So are there other ways? I haven't experienced them, but I've read a lot of research on plant medicines, you know, mm-hmm. ayahuasca, psilocybin, mushrooms, stuff like that. When it's done with a shaman, with a specific intention, properly, not like a party drug, that they're having actually a lot of success with that. So, you know, that is, I don't have personal success with that, but I mean, there's a shaman here, you know, my friend's a shaman that lives right down the path from me, you know, So, you know, I'm surrounded by the plant medicine. There's a retreat going on right now.
That's cool.
And it's all happening here this week, you know, so all kinds of cambo and all kinds of plant medicines. So, and cambo is another one that has had some benefits with addiction. So, I mean, there is that, that's something that people can look into. And there are a lot of places actually in the States that you can do stuff like that. You know, and of course you can come over to the DR, and Costa Rica is famous for it, you know.
I know someone in Costa Rica. Different experience for everyone, I guess, but you know.
Yeah, it's.
Oh, definitely, you know, listen.
It's stuff, yeah. So that's one avenue people can look into. And there are others that I'm less familiar with. There's a Buddhist path in recovery that I've heard good things about. So there are other things out there. My take on it is this, other than what I just said, it's the amount of people that have gotten sober through the 12-step program of Alcoholics Anonymous or NA, you know, CA, stuff like that, you know, drugs and alcohol. And there's, I think there's around 100 12-step programs now. So there's one for just about everything out there.
Yeah.
The amount of people that, and why is there so many? It's because it's been working since, I think, 1939.
Right.
It's gotten literally hundreds of millions of people sober, by far head and shoulders, not even in a ballpark above everything else. You know, it was the first thing that worked. Is it the only thing? Nope. But it's the first thing, and it's, you know, I don't know. Yeah, it's, like you said, you know, I would probably say that about 90% of the people, you know, this is just me guessing, 90% of the people that have gotten sober have probably gotten sober. And I mean transcended their addictions fully. And were actual addicts, because a lot of people are, well, not a lot. Some people are heavy drinkers and think that they're alcoholics. And they go, no, I was an alcoholic, but I just stopped one day. Yeah, then you weren't an alcoholic.
Right.
Most likely you were not an alcoholic, because, you know, just because you got tore up every night for 14 years doesn't mean you're an alcoholic. If you can just stop, you probably weren't. Now, can people just stop? Maybe. 3 out of 7.8 billion people on the planet. maybe. Yeah. You know? But yeah, so most people that just stopped weren't actually addicts and alcoholics, in my opinion. So I'd probably say 90% of the addicts and alcoholics that have gotten sober up until this point in this time in history have done so through a 12-step program. And I've worked with a lot of people just as a life coach with addictions and alcoholism. And quite honestly, I 99% of the time, and also like people with Al-Anon, you know, with family members that are struggling with addiction. And 90% of the time when you're dealing with addiction like this, you need constant food. You need constant support. It overtakes your psyche and the way you think and the way you interact so much so that you need that constant support. So, you know, having somebody to talk to once a day, every day, you know, going to a meeting 3, 5, 7 times a week, depending on the person. Like, it's just having that all the time, having a structured program that you go through, boom, 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 do this. That's, and you're guided through that process to induce the inner psychic change that's necessary. That, what was that guy, Carl Jung said. It was when he was dealing with Roland Hazard before AA got started. Roland Hazard was this real rich guy from Rhode Island that ended up going over to work with Carl Jung overseas because he was the biggest name out there at the time. And Carl Jung and Roland Hazard works with Carl Jung for, I think, months, maybe. Didn't make it back to the United States on a ship before he got tanked, before he was drinking again. And he calls up Carl Jung and he's like, what the heck, man? You know? And he's like, dude, like I was trying to induce an inner psychic change within you. And unless that occurs, it's very likely, you know, and I wasn't able to induce it in you. Like, what do you want me to say? That's what the 12 steps does. It induces a psychic change within you. And my belief is that those 12 steps were written in one sitting. And I think it was in something like 15 minutes or something.
Wow.
That was channeled from divine wisdom.
Absolutely.
You know, and so is the rest of this book. So is all other divine, you know, spiritual texts were all channeled.
Yeah.
You know, from divine wisdom. So, so was this. So I think, you know, so in my opinion, the 12-step program that is literally walks you through to induce your psychic change, your change of perspective, your spiritual awakening, coupled that with the community of support and a constant food available to you on a daily basis. I don't know how you can replace that. And I've worked with alcoholics and like, I can't charge, like you can't, I mean, I believe in the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous and, you know, and I value the institution. So I do not charge people as a life coach to get them sober, but to take them through the steps because that's part of AA, you know, so I don't charge people to do that, but I have tried working with people and again Al-Anon people as well as AA people, addiction people and people in a family trying to deal with an addict. I have dealt with them and I always end up directing them towards these programs because like to be able to talk to me every day, you're going to be paying me thousands of dollars a week, you know, just to, where you can go get it for free.
Right.
You know, it's like, and you have a bigger community. It's not just me. It's multiple people, you know? So, I mean, this is why I'm a big proponent of the program. And, and you know, the problem that I've seen with most people with the program is the spiritual aspect of it and or the community. Like some people have had bad experiences in AA or NA and oh, these people, and you know, these guys were jerks to me or what. There's jerks everywhere.
Yeah.
You know, The most often, the biggest block for people going in there is they, it's when you're talking, when you're fighting for your life, it's not a good enough excuse. You know, and that's how I see it. It's like they, you know, talking with an alcoholic or an addict and like them going, no, yeah, AA isn't for me. I'm not saying that AA is for everybody. What I am saying is that 90% of the people that say AA isn't for me, the reason they're saying AA isn't for me is because they still think they're in control of their life, which is the problem in the first place.
Yeah.
You know, this is the beginning for my sponsor was he kept getting thrown out of a rehab facility his first day because he was acting like an alcoholic and an addict. And an alcoholic and an addict, the way that you continue drinking for and using for a long period of time is through manipulation of circumstances and people. You always find a way to get what you need to continue.
Yeah.
You find a way to rationalize it, to talk other people into it, to flip things around, whatever you need to do. And you're most of them are really good at it. So as long as an alcoholic or an addict is in control, they're not going to get sober.
Yeah.
You know, so the first thing is to strip their power away and say you are not in control of what happens over the next 3 months or 6 months.
Yeah. You just got to get
because as long as you are, they're going to keep choosing what poor behavior because that's all they know, you know? Yeah. So my sponsor kept getting thrown out because he's like trying to, well, let's negotiate this. And they're like, get out. Like, wait. If you throw me out, I'm going to lose my job. They're like, yeah, get out. All right. I'll do it your way. Okay. They take him to his room. Okay. So I want to talk to you about this. Get out. He's like, well, you guys stop throwing me out of this place. And it's because you think you're in control. That's the problem. You're not, you know? And so when he came to me, he was like, is there any area of your life that is not effed up? I'm like, no, I think I got it all. It's like, anything. Is there anything that isn't effed up? I'm like, no. Did you try to F it up? No. Did you try to do well? Yes. Okay. Would it be fair to say that your best thinking effed up your entire life? Yes. Would it be fair to say that your best thinking sucks? Yes. I had to say yes. That's a fair statement. My best thinking sucked. Because I did the best I could and everything in my life was messed up. Yeah. My son was 1,400 miles away. My body was literally shutting down after being a personal trainer. My organs were shutting down. I was homeless. No car, no house. I used to rollerblade to the package store to pick up beer. Literally. But yeah, my organs were shutting down. Like I was literally dying.
Wow.
So it's like, you know, that's what my best thinking got me. So I had to understand that. And what that did is I understood that I was a blank slate. And he said, just do what I say for 3 months. Give me 3 months of your life. Do everything that I say, live my way, depend on my thinking. Do you think my life's going better than yours? Yep. Okay, then depend on my thinking for 3 months. What do you got to lose? Your life sucks anyway.
Right.
So try it. And if it doesn't work, I'll gladly refund your misery.
Yeah. I love that. Yeah. You can take it back.
And I realized, I was like, yeah, I don't have anything to lose. Like what am I holding? Because we think, you know, I was like, oh no, I can't allow somebody else to control my life.
Yeah.
Why?
Right.
Yeah. You know, why? Because it might get better. It can't get worse.
Yeah.
Like, you know, but that created a blank slate.
Yeah. How willing are you to make it better?
Right. And it just, I didn't, that was great for me because I didn't trust my thinking, and I shouldn't trust my thinking back then. I shouldn't have. It destroyed my life.
Yeah.
You know, so I trusted somebody else, and I did things even though I knew 110% they were wrong and they were going to fail. But I did them anyway. And half the time I did them to prove to my sponsor that he was wrong. And every time they worked out. And it blew my mind. I was sitting here going, are you flipping kidding me? I cannot believe that worked. I knew that was going to fail.
Wow.
And I was just like, my mind was blown.
Yeah.
So then I, you know, so I did. I checked with him on everything. And then I started, like, when I check with him, I start actually getting it right more consistently. Mm-hmm. So that's when I, little by little, it took me about a year to start trusting my thinking, maybe a year and a half, until I really trusted my thinking.
Wow.
You know, and I would still check things, you know, big things, yeah, just to make sure I didn't screw them up.
Maintenance after that.
Yeah.
Maintenance. Yeah.
So yeah. So that's, I think, you know, become that blank slate. This is why when people tell me, oh, the program isn't for me, 90% of the time, like sometimes it's not, but 90% of the time, it's just them trying to stay in control. How do you know what's right for you? And like,
right,
you're destroying your whole life. You can't function, but you know what's right for you?
Right. How?
Doesn't
work.
So, yeah. So that's my, that's kind of my take, you know. It's
love it.
It's not for everybody, but I think it is for most, and more people than they think it's for.
Direction, them. Some kind of direction.
Yeah.
Discipline. Yeah.
All right. Well, we got to wrap it up before this hour hits. So yeah. Here we are. Yeah. All right. Cool. So I'm going to wrap it up. Thank you everybody for listening. Thank you, Aubrey.
Thank you. Thanks everyone.
And, we'll reach out if you need some help.
Looking for more? Check out over 200 episodes of Life Lessons and Laughter, or click the link in the description of this episode to connect with Glenn directly.